Welcome to the Mohammer Podcast, episode 5. I'm Mo and I'm here with Luke and reviews and subterranean editor Jonathan Seltzer is back with us again. Hello.
Hello.
Loved it so much last time you come back again. Elle's off having a lovely time in New York, which we'll tell us about next week. It's been a busy few days in Hammerwell for all of us. We've got the new issue out, of course, which we talked about not next week. We'll talk about it next week as well. That's what we do. We did, of course, get Tony Iommi and Rob Halford in a room together for our world-exclusive front cover. It's the only place you'll read this interview this year and possibly ever. It's out in all stores right now, as we went through last week. But don't forget, there's also stuff in there from Dave Mustaine, Sepultura, Love Bites, Aelstorm. More on that in a bit, actually, when it comes to Aelstorm. Conjurer, Vile Creature, Primordial, Turnstile, Parkway Drive, Between the Buried and Me, Andrew WK. It's stacked, it's out in shops right now, and as always, we appreciate your support. You can also hear a bit more from Mr. Halford alongside Ian Hill in a feature-length podcast featuring our Luke right here. Metal Hammer meets Judas Priest is also online via iTunes. Get on it. Don't forget to subscribe, rate the podcast. Yeah. Come join our family. If you're listening now, that's you've done part of it already. So just keep on supporting it. We much, much appreciate it.
I'm enjoying the hugging hand gestures you're doing that no one can see.
Oh, yeah, I am. I'm being inclusive. But yeah, no one can hear it. Help me help you. Come towards us.
Yeah, a big virtual hug.
I'm sorry. I did drama at A-level. I taught with my hands a lot. Useless. What's been going on, boys? What have we been up to? Jonathan, you've been away. You were up in Norway, which doesn't surprise me at all.
No one's great surprise. So I was at the Bionorm Festival, which isn't
awesome.
Actually a metal festival as such, but they always have a metal stage.
Yes.
So I was there. I was chairing a panel.
It's kind of like a mini. I went there last year myself. It's kind of like a mini South by Southwest kind of vibe, isn't it? So there's panels, bands playing.
That's right. And possibly a bit more arty than South by Southwest. The few bands I did see, they were very on a kind of more jazzy avant-garde side. So the whole of Oslo, or the centre of Oslo, gets taken over for a few days, and it was really good vibe. The whole town, you know, it's lots of different kinds of crowds. Obviously, I was kind of checking out most of the metal bands, and running a panel on something we're also going to talk about later on, which is the. The splitting of metal into various subgenres and sub subgenres and so on and so forth. Till who knows where we are or who we are anymore.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll pick on that later. I was in France, lads. I went to Montpellier, which is all right. Like quite a pretty little French town, and I went to see Carpenter Brut, who's kind of the biggest name in the synthwave phenomenon that we've talked about a little bit on the podcast, and we've covered quite a lot in the magazine as well. If you haven't heard about what we've said about it already, first of all, go back and check out the other podcast. What the hell's the matter with you? But there's this kind of burgeoning synthwave dance metal scene that's just taken over the underground. I mean, so what are your thoughts on it, Jonathan? As the kind of gatekeeper of the underground, what are your thoughts on synthwave and this kind of 80s dance metal thing that's going on?
First of all, you know, I grew up in the 80s.
Right.
So I kind of remember all the era this music came from. But for me, like, where synthwave is coming from to a large extent isn't really the more sort of avant-garde side of the 80s. Like, last week I talked about bands like Japan, and you know, there's a lot more kind of atmospheric electronic music going on around then. So this sounds like Jan Hammer with a slightly added metal touch to it,
right?
And so it's kind of a little bit too brash for me. I prefer like electronic music with a bit more atmosphere and depth to it. But you know, so many metalheads grew up in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of get this. And there is a kind of...
And even the ones that don't, there's a real affinity for that as well. You know, there's plenty of people under the age of 30 that are obsessed with Stranger Things. You know, because it just speaks to a certain nostalgic culture, which for some people they weren't even there for.
Yeah, and it's strange that the 80s is coming back in loads of different ways, not just in this. I mean, the whole kind of rise of post-punk has come back into the metal scene, particularly the underground metal scene. I think... you know, Beast Milk, then Grave Pleasures kind of started that off.
Matt is actually on the new Carpenter Brut album.
Yeah. Yes,
Matt from Grave Pleasures, which is...
Yeah. So the 80s is back in a big way, and I'm not quite sure why, what it is about the 80s that really speaks to us at the moment. I mean, in post-rock, in post-punk, there was a lot of sense of alienation, and I think, the synthwave stuff, it kind of has that kind of sense of alienation, but it's with actual aliens.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a very interesting thing to go into why 80s culture is running right everywhere. I mean, getting to see a couple of us. You were at Perturbator, weren't you?
No, I saw him at Roadburn last
year. Right, that's it. Yeah, sorry. So we've both seen Perturbator before, who's also kind of like, I guess, the Slayer to Carpenter Brut's Metallica. But yeah, it's the first time seeing the biggest name in synthwave in his homeland as well. About probably just under a 1,000 cap venue in there. But I know he's going on to do a 3,000 cap in Paris, actually, playing the Olympia, which is a big venue. So yeah, there's a lot going on there. And it was fucking great. It was just brilliant to see, I would say, a majority heavy metal crowd.
Yeah.
Not all metalheads at all. There was like, you could definitely tell there's just fans from across the spectrum in there. But I'd say about 60% of the people in there definitely go home and listen to a Monomath. And to see those people throw in the wildest shapes imaginable to this kind of high-octane electro-rock 80s vibe was just amazing. And the show was great. You had this big LED screen that could fit a venue three times the size of the one we were in. Really great light show. The visuals were great in general because they had all these kind of like, again, like 80s inspired kind of schlocky horror movie segments and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it was awesome. And Turbo Killer, which if you haven't seen the Turbo Killer video, if you do one thing off the back of this podcast, apart from reading the new issue, obviously, and listening to the Judas Priest one, got the plugs in.
Nice.
If you do one other thing, go and check out the Turbo Killer video. It was Jonathan actually showed it to me last year, and it's the wildest thing ever. And when he dropped that, it was like Metallica dropping Enter Sandman. Like, people were going crazy for everything, but that song is the anthem.
Yeah.
I know he's coming over here he's playing Coco in London. I think that's sold out, and he's got a date in Manchester too, I think. If you happen to be going to those shows, you're in for an absolute party. If you can find a way to go, but you haven't got a ticket yet, just do it, because it will be one of the parties of the year for sure. It was really, really good. I'm very excited about what's going on in that scene right now. What's going on in the world of metal then? The wider world of metal.
Well, it has finally happened, guys. Tool are in the studio. They're actually there.
Are they?
Yes. They said they are. They've said they are now. It's happened.
How do we know they are?
They have said that...
Who's they?
The band.
But who? I mean, they all said different stuff all the time.
I know, but it's official now. It's everywhere you look, Tool are in the studio.
Okay. Right.
It's happened. It's happening this year, surely.
I still can't believe it. Well, it's taken them 8 years to... No, sorry, what am I talking about? 12 years?
12 years
12
to
years to get into the studio. So we might see the album in another 3 years?
No. Sure, well...
well, I fucking know.
Another 10,000 days.
A Perfect Circle have literally just started a whole new cycle. So Maynard's off doing other shit for the facility.
Yeah.
When is he even going to get in the studio?
I feel like
I've just popped some balloons.
I know. There'll be a way for him to make it work, because there's obviously music out there, because we keep seeing all these stories about other bands going and listening to the new Tool stuff. Like Melvin's heard it, I think Nurgle's heard it, and Tom Morello's heard it, and people like that.
It's a strange mix. Like Melvin's going into like
that is a Tool dinner party I'd want to be at. The Melvin's, Maynard, James Keenan, and Nurgle. Amazing. Wow. Well, we'll remain to be seen what happens.
Well, I am stoked, and I reckon it's going to come this year. Saying it now, this year.
Good, good, good. Record Store Day have announced this year's releases. There's loads of stuff going on. You can check out Metal Hammer for the full rundown of all the metal-relevant Record Store Day stuff going on. When is it?
It is April the something.
Pass it.
No! Cheers, what is it? It's the weekend
Get
of...
Get your phone out and check.
It's the weekend of Roadburn. When is it? It is.
Oh, that means it's the...
20...
Yeah, because that's the weekend Trivium come to town on
it's
their
the
metal
21st of April, I believe.
Awesome.
It's Saturday.
Well done. 21st of April, do go to Metal Hammer to check out all the stuff you need to know about. There's stuff coming from Creator, Mastodon, Celtic Frost, loads of shit going on. You guys into Record Store Day? It's kind of a bit of a debate about whether it's important.
No, I hate Record Store Day.
Oh, no, don't be that guy.
Interesting.
No, the reason... Well, for lots of different reasons. First of all, it ruins it for everybody else because no one can get... Like, for me as a reviews editor, it's made my life difficult because a lot of releases have had to go back because they can't get vinyl made because the Record Store Day is taking it all up.
Right.
And so Record Store Day messes up everybody's schedules. It does because there's so few record pressing plants. Mm. So they just all get taken up by Record Store Day for months on end in advance. Second of all, you just can't buy the thing you want because it's just, unless you're there like at 7 in the morning, because the crowds are just ridiculous. I'm sure most people buying stuff aren't buying it to own. It's just pure speculation. Mm. That's why you can't get hold of the things that you're after, because like some idiot's gone and bought it and they're never going to play it, and they're going to sort of sell it 3 days later for three times the price.
That's not good. But you're into it, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm into it. I've been.
You're that guy queuing up at 7 a.m.
Not 7 a.m, but I'm usually queuing. Yeah,
7:40.
Yes, 7:40.
If I'm like a band, I will go out straight and still buy like the box set of something. Mm. But when it's a limited edition, just to one day and a few, and you know that most of the people who are going to buy it, they'll probably just buy anything they can get their hands on because they know they can sell it for 3 days later. And it's not really getting into the hands of the people who are fans of the bands.
Interesting.
I do agree with what you mean. I've talked to a few bands and independent labels in the past saying that, you know, the big labels basically take up all the vinyl plants for a month so they can't do anything. But all the times I've been queuing outside, you know, record shops in London or whatever, it does seem to be generally music fans that are there. I know what you mean. You do always see stuff on eBay the day after. And yeah, and that sucks, you know, that you've got a record up there for 300 quid when you went and bought it for 20 quid because only 1,000 exists. But I, you know, I've got some really cool stuff out of it that I, you know, cherish.
What's the best thing you picked up for your record store?
Well, the two things that spring to mind is I've got the translucent vinyl of Volume 3 by Slipknot.
Oh, nice.
Which...
nice. Yeah, Morton as fuck, that is.
Fuck, no, I've only played it once because I didn't want to ruin it.
Yeah.
I think it was last year, maybe the year before, I got the picture disc Alan Partridge record.
Two most disparate things. Slipknot and Partridge. You might be the only person with those two.
Yeah, items. Quite possibly. But yeah, it's amazing. It's two of his radio shows from the 90s, and it's just Alan's face on the record spinning round and round. It's really, really good.
I'm genuinely blown away by that. I'm really impressed.
I'm amazed that they did that for Record Store Day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, did that record. And there's a Fawlty Towers record coming out this time round as well, which I think I might end up buying because I think it's a picture disc Fawlty Towers.
Was just the main theme? Over and over again.
No, I think it's like a show, but like audio only. I don't know. I've just seen it on the Epic list that's doing the rounds.
I mean, John Clay's kicking things.
It's just, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I could go quite that far. I mean, I've got there's a Lord of the Rings one coming out that I don't think is for Record Store Day, but it looks amazing. And I've got the Hellraiser Blood Splattered soundtrack, but that's something I might actually play.
That's cool.
I don't know if I'll ever play a Fawlty Towers picture.
No, very true. One soundtrack's the weirdest and coolest one I've got is a bright blue vinyl of Mega Drive soundtracks.
No, fucking hell. Yeah. I need to see your record collection. Ridiculous.
I used to go into like secondhand stores and just buy the most ridiculous records ever. Like you, or in charity.
Yeah,
shops.
I know. You got me for Secret Santa one year.
What was it?
You got me one year for Secret Santa. We do Secret Santa at Metal Hammer, of course. Secret Satan, I should say. One year, I knew it was him because it was just the most Jonathan thing ever. I got what looked like a vinyl shaped present, and I was like, "What is this going to be? Oh my god, it's really exciting!" I open it up, and it was a vintage 70s KFC Christmas songs set.
The Colonel's Christmas songs
with the Colonel. From KFC on
the
front
of
Christmas.
That's amazing.
So yeah, cheers for that. But still, that is still there. I've still got it in my collection. Fuck knows when I'll play it, but it's there. So yeah,
Christmas, I guess. Final.
Speaking of weird shit, what is this about Fred Durst now? Can you explain this to me?
Yeah, I saw that this morning. Fred Durst is directing a movie called Moose.
Okay, hold on, I'll stop you there.
Okay.
Fred Durst is directing a movie.
Yeah, I thought that too, but apparently this will be the third movie he's directed.
Oh.
Yeah, well, I know. I've
handing in my new Metal Warrior.
I know, so I haven't seen either of the other two, obviously.
I should say that we are firmly on board with Limp Bizkit on this podcast. Yeah. We do not join in the shit kicking.
I am limping with the biscuit all day.
Well, that was a bit white.
That was. I think it's from the outro of Chocolate Starfish, but yeah.
That said, I'm not sure if... Fred Durst and hold on, sorry, finish off the headline.
Right, yeah, Fred Durst is directing a movie called Moose, which is starring John Travolta.
Okay.
And it's about, apparently, a obsessive stalker who basically gets obsessed with an Hollywood actor, I think, and with hilarious results. But no, probably it's a thriller.
And you won't believe what happened.
Yes. No, it's like a side, like a bit of a thriller, like, you know, and apparently there's some autobiographical element to it from Fred. I imagine he's
so it's about Fred getting a stalker.
Or Fred being a stalker.
Yeah, we don't.
We remember those lyrics.
Yeah, so there's a very limited information out there at the minute, but it does seem that like Fred's own experience with stalkers is tying into this story called Moose.
Wow.
So
interesting to watch.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think
Hetfield's in a film about a serial killer, and Fred Durst is directing something about a stalker. What's going on?
Just release an album.
What are all my heroes doing? Stop this. Just do some work. No, joking.
Yeah, put the new Biscuit album out. Come
on. Where's the new Biscuit album? Come on, fuck Tool. Where's the new Limp Biscuit album? I've been waiting for that Stampede of the Disco Elephants for about 4 years now. Sort it out. Oh, anyway. One of the things we go into in a lot of depth in the new issue is a big feature with Aylstorm, who are unbelievably 10 years old now. Captain Morgan's Revenge, that first album, which is actually pretty fucking good, to be fair, is now 10 years old. So we've had a lot of dialogue about bands like Aylstorm, and they're probably the best example of this in the Hammer office over the years. I mean, since I've been there, really, like, and beyond. And, you know, if we're being honest, we've probably always been a bit snidey about them. You know, we haven't really done anything significant with them for a long time. And it was only when we clocked that, A, they've been going 10 years now. And, B, they sold out the Forum in London, which is, you know...
2,500 people.
2,500 people that we kind of went, OK, we need to kind of readdress this and you know, start giving them some fucking credit again.
Yeah.
I mean, are you guys fans of Aylstorm first and foremost?
In short, no.
Okay, Martin.
To be fair, I think we mentioned it in the podcast the other week. When you put the first album on, it was like, oh, I know this one, I like this one, for every song.
Yeah.
And it was they were the first band they ever reviewed for a website.
They were one of the first bands I reviewed as well.
Yeah, I went to see them at Rock City Basement, which was, I don't know, like 10 years ago or something.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's like, it's just weird. I'd never really knew much about them, but I was like, oh, wicked, I'm going to review a gig, I'll check it out. And yeah, it was about a couple of hundred people there, sold out, most of them dressed as pirates, losing their fucking minds.
So I guess that's kind of what it taps into with Aylstorm, because when it comes to metal, we like to be proud, you like what you like, you shouldn't feel ashamed to like anything, on a musical level, at least. you know, you like what you like, and if anyone tries to guilt trip you because the band's a bit naff or whatever, and so on and so forth. But metal in particular does seem to have, I don't want to say it's an issue, but it certainly has a long-standing affinity with kind of gimmickry and how far bands are able to get on gimmickry and kind of stupid shit that maybe some people would argue takes them to a much higher platform than they probably deserve. Necrogoblicon, I'm looking at you. Because they suck. So I mean, when it comes to this kind of stuff, where do you draw a line with this shit? Because I found myself having to justify just wanting to put on an Aylstorm album, which I shouldn't, because I actually think when you get past the fact that it's stupid as fuck, and they'll be the first to admit that, as you will see when you read the feature in the issue, the music's good. They do some good music. It's just good power metal-y kind of.
So that's the thing. It's
high-octane stuff.
If they were shit, then it wouldn't be funny. Or not even that it's funny. It wouldn't even be entertaining. It's just, look, they're pirates. But they are good musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's entertaining. But I think in terms of how far bands can get on gimmicks, you know, it's not a new thing at all. Yeah.
You know,
in the same way, you know, Kiss wore makeup. Everyone's went, okay, well done. You're.
I mean, I might not like Aylstorm, but I've got nothing against the band or this idea of like absurdity in metal, because we're all metal fans. We all understand there's a level of absurdity in there, and you know, I like it when that gets celebrated, when it's done really smartly. And you know, I'm in a huge glass house because I really like Tourist Ass. And I really love Trollfest.
Trollfest,
who are like the most ridiculous of the lot.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you want to quickly describe Trollfest, because they're a bit less. Famous than Teresa.
Yeah, so, but if you go on the continent, they're actually bigger than any of the other bands. So there's about like 10 of them running around on stage. they're actually, you wouldn't Jesus know Christ. This, but they're actually, a lot of them are actually Norwegian black metal musicians doing this ridiculous, like hyperactive
troll metal.
Well, it's not really troll metal. It's kind of really Balkan.
I love the way you went. Well, it's not troll metal. That's a whole different thing.
They don't really sing about trolls.
They don't understand troll metal.
Yeah, but they've got this kind of Balkan thing going around, like in their sound. You know, they look either like some kind of post-apocalyptic hobos, or
that's a band name in itself.
Yeah, or like some crazy, like gypsy crew in like they just nick some tracksuits and stuff.
Yeah,
and it's but the music is really well put together. I mean, they're, you know, on a folk level, folk music level, they really know their stuff, and it's just taken up to this kind of point of absurdity where you just don't really know where you are anymore. But it's kind of, but you know, also if you grew up with Hanna-Barbera cartoons,
mm-hmm.
and you'll get the kind of level of hyperactivity in it. But it's almost to the point of surrealism. Like, you can't really match those things together. So this mixture of like surrealism and actually really knowing your shit musically, and actually referencing lots of different kind of parts of folk metal, and knowing how that music works really well, it's just like just adds up to what the fuck.
Right.
And you know, Tour Sass are also, you know, they're really self aware. They're really funny. I love the fact that when they first played Download, they had 25 minutes and they spent at least 15 of those just talking shit in between songs. but that's what made everyone love them. I saw them when they first played The Underworld in front of 50 people, and I just, you could tell then this band were going to be huge.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw Elstorm was supporting 2SS, and I just thought, well,
I remember that tour.
Yeah, they played at the Electric Ballroom, and I was thinking, well, here's a really shit version of 2SS, and yet here's a bunch of people who seem to absolutely fucking love them. Like, possibly even more than 2SS, and they were supporting.
But I guess with Elstorm, because I guess this is kind of where there's a bit of a divide there, because a lot of, I mean, first of all, you mentioned like Europe. Yeah, this shit is massive in Europe, like all of it is. I think that's where Elstorm kind of really made their bread and butter before they started to properly blow up more over here. But in Europe, there's a certain sense of identity and like cultural significance with a lot of what's going on here. Like, what Tourezas do is kind of in their blood, and it's, you know, it's more than just...
Yeah.
With the best of respect to pirates, I think I just struggle to... I can't really think of many people that are that invested in piracy as a kind of cultural trait that you can explore and go into. Like, these are literally just sitting down and writing stupid songs about getting fucked with an anchor.
Yeah.
It's literally one of their songs. So yeah, that's a bit of an odd thing. Where do you draw the line with that stuff? Where do you go, this is too stupid now? Is there anything that's too stupid?
Well,
are we just being too snide?
But the thing is, like, you know, but they're still somehow being able to like dredge records out of it, you know, whether you like them or not.
Five.
Yeah, but in the same
five
way.
Five albums.
But look at Cannabis Corpse. You know, they're still doing records where all the song titles are kind of...
this is weed puns.
Yeah, weed puns based on classic records, classic metal tracks.
That's got to work. It's got to run out at some point.
They've got about three or four albums in now.
Interesting.
And they're really good, actually.
Well, I suppose they're kind of, the dam is broken once and for all on this with baby metal, because you, on one side of it, you can't really, like, realistically argue that putting three teenage girls in kitsunes in front of a metal band dressed up in a certain way, I mean, the band are, like, they're dressed up kind of like a little bit corpse painty ghoulishly looking, and say that's not a gimmick, because it is. Like, someone's literally just taken idol culture and just smashed it into metal. But I genuinely don't think they would have got as big as they've got and gone straight out to Wembley Arena or all that if the songs weren't good. And I think there are at least a few of the songs on that second album they put out were really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, I like baby metal.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Not because I think they're... but then I don't think they're metal band. I like them because it's just like...
Don't you start.
No, everyone hates them and said, well, this isn't how metal should be.
Yeah.
It's like, well, they're never supposed to be like that because they're not a metal band. They're like a J-pop band. But it's like, I like seeing heavy metal like reflected in this weird lens of J-pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the general surrealism of it. I actually prefer the first album.
Of all the people to go there with, baby metal.
Yeah, I know, but the first album's a lot more tacky, and it's just that pure sugar rush you get off the even the non-metal bits.
Yeah,
like Doki Doki Morning is just like, it's just like, what the fuck? But it just hits some weird pleasure center in your brain. Mm. And, you know, you can't defend against it, for all, you know, me being like, oh, I'm so a mess with
it. I guess you shouldn't have to, though, should you? That's the point. Like, why are we so snidey about this stuff? Well, people are snidey.
Yeah,
like, it took us 10 years to kind of properly do an Alestorm feature, because it was just kind of, wow, it's piracy and it's stupid, but it's the metal scene in general just too snidey to this shit.
I think there's an air of, you know, just being cynical, and you don't, because everyone who likes metal really is so invested in metal. It's not a genre that you sort of dip your toe in every now and again. And you just don't want anyone, especially, to take the piss out of it. And I think that's sort of it. You don't want.
Right.
I think it's a fear of someone getting big that's basically taking the piss out of what you've spent your entire life.
Which is why a lot of people still can't get on board with Steel Panther, and why a lot of people hate the darkness. And
yeah, but the thing is, Steel Panther, they do West Coast metal better than anyone else.
Well, I was going to say, at the end of the day, it's not Steel Panther's fault that not a single one of the bands that inspired them has put out an album half as good as Feel the Steel in 30
but
years.
If you're going to take the piss out of something and do it well, you have to know that genre much better than all the also-rans and the wannabes who want to be, you know, trying to be Motley Crue.
Absolutely.
Like, it's such a weird take on West Coast rock.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, where did you draw the line then? I can't get on board with Necrogoblicon.
No, I saw it once and I didn't need to. If you don't know
what we're talking about, don't worry about it.
Yes.
I think it's my line keeps extending. It's like, okay, I draw the line here, and I go and see Evil Scarecrow live at Wacken.
Scarecrow is another big one.
I'm on board with Evil Scarecrow.
And it's just like, I don't think the songs are good enough. That's what I thought. And then I saw them live and I kind of really enjoyed it. And I just think, you know, if you're going to go that far with all your props, there's got to be some kind of seriousness of intent, because they really put all their all into
it.
There's
a difference between doing kind of silly art but also still taking the art seriously.
But you can tell they're really genuine metal fans and they're still invested in metal. And so, yeah, and I saw, is it Power Quest or some ridiculous power metal bands that I saw in at Wacken? Maybe it's because you saw them in Wacken.
Hold on, Power Quest, that's Christopher from Elstone's band, isn't it?
Oh, maybe not them then. But there was this one band.
Am I being stupid? Yeah, my Euro metal knowledge is not.
Yeah, but then I keep thinking about.
I'm pretty sure Christopher Bowes from Hailstorm has got like a super goofy. Oh no, that's Gloryhammer, isn't it?
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
I think that's
might have been Power Quest than the one I saw.
I don't know.
And I keep drawing the line and thinking, I quite like this, and that's it. It's just like it's still heavy metal, and you know, I love ridiculously absurd metal things. I love Niflheim with the most ridiculous, but
Niflheim are hilarious.
Yeah,
I mean that's a good one.
Like literally my favourite live metal band in the world, and they're the most absurd metal band in the world, but so truly metal. And I love the fact that, you know, that there's this grey area between metal and absolutely fucking ridiculous, and you know, I love the fact that metal's absurd.
Yes.
And all the things you can do with absurdity.
Absolutely. You don't have to like it, but in some cases I think you just got to respect what they've done and how they've got here, and that is certainly the case with Hailstorm. So I do pick up their new issue to read our extended feature with them. It's fascinating the journey they've been on, and the fact that after 10 years they are still here smashing out pirate metal songs and headlining to thousands of people. So fair play, pick up the issue to check out more.
And if you hate Hailstorm, you can also pick up the same issue and see Alan von Primordial going on about how much he hates.
Yeah, that's actually true. Against all odds, for no reason, doing of our own, we also have an interview, very good interview with Alan from Primordial, and he happens to talk about how shit Hailstorm are. So you've got both sides of the argument in one issue. That's what we do at Metal Hammer. We give you every chance to debate. What have our wonderful readers on the Metal Hammer Facebook group been asking us?
Well, Merlin, Craig Huntley asks, what would you bring back to festivals and you can't save the sun?
What do you mean?
I don't know.
Okay, good. Next.
Well, no.
Huge amounts of drugs?
Well, that's it.
I'm pretty sure those haven't gone away yet.
I think it depends when how far you look back at festivals. Because, like, people keep pointing at, we mentioned it a few weeks ago, like Reading and Leeds. And it felt like back then you'd take way more of a punt on a headliner that was probably only Brixton Academy level.
Yeah.
As headliner, whereas now they have to be a stadium dominating band to be considered headline worthy.
Yeah, I mean, I used to go to Reading and Reading Festival every year, but there's also like V Festival and Phoenix Festival, and you know, so when I used to write for Melody Maker back in the sort of 90s or whatever, And but you had bands like the Young Gods, who are like a really influential but kind of underground band. You had Porno for Pyros headlining Reading, and I think it might say more about the state of alternative music back then against the state of alternative music now. But in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, independent music, indie music was really sort of out there and really heavy and really innovative, and you had like Pixies and Three Muses and Swans, and that was indie music. And now it just seems all very kind of bourgeois, middle class, safe, and nothing really, and also very backwards looking indie music seems to be, says the metal fan. But
I can't really.
Also, bottle fights. I used to quite enjoy a bottle fight.
I don't know. They might still.
I've not seen my big one happen. Were you there at Download Festival when 2006 when Korn obviously finished early because Jonathan Davis wasn't there?
Yes,
Metallica were coming.
That was crazy.
But there was like an hour of nothing happening on stage, and the crowd was just going insane. And he looked up and he couldn't even see the sun because it was just thick with
that
bottles.
That was wild, wasn't it?
There were famous festival bottling incidents. Obviously, Daphne and Celeste at Reading Festival.
Were you there for that one?
I think we should be wary of imploring people to bring back bottling.
But before Hellfest, there was Fury Fest, and Slipknot got massively bottled for about like half an hour. Because apparently they took out all the backstage, so no one else could sound check and work it out. So by the time they came on stage, people were just like, they were throwing everything they could possibly find at the band for half an hour.
I was at Reading the year that 50 Cent got bottled so hard that he went off stage after like 10 minutes, and it was wild. Like, I mean, again, not something you should necessarily like promote, but I remember because he was in between Placebo and Green Day, I think it was.
Interesting.
And this is when Green Day were just on the verge of being a woo-woo dickhead band, but they were still better back then. And I remember seeing like old school punks who still went to Reading at that point walking past with bin liners just filled with bottles ready for 50 to come out.
Fuck.
And I remember when he did come out, he had tons of his crew with him and stuff, and they all jumped out. There's like these really long banquet tables set up at the back of the stage, and they all ran out on stage, chucked the tablecloths off the tables, and they had about 50 filled water bottles on there just waiting to go. So they all started chucking them back in the crowd again, and the crowd were chucking them at the thing. It was fucking mental. And then I remember he said something like, you know, you can throw what you want, I ain't going anywhere. And then someone threw a deck chair on stage. It was so... I mean, I like 50 Cent, by the way. I like, you know...
Take that hint, good stuff.
But
throw a deck chair.
I know, I was like, they've lost money doing that. It was fucking crazy. And he held out the crowd during Pimp, and he was like, because I'm a motherfucking, and the whole crowd in unison went wanker. It's like most English moment ever. I'm not saying I'll bring that back, but
no,
definitely I don't think you probably get that as much at Reading in 2018. So there you go.
Yeah,
but don't do it. It's
don't
naughty.
Do it. It's bad.
It's naughty. Definitely naughty. Oh, and there was the year that the Rasmus got bottled, and someone chucked a lump of mud, and it hit the cymbal, and everyone went yeah. It went, oh dear. Never mind. Don't do that though.
Bad thing to do.
So, Daniel Lapointe asks, what aspects do you look for most in a local metal band for local people? What do you think is the best way for a small band to get recognition from larger sources?
Just be good.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
All bands are...
Just be good.
Local.
Yeah, is that your local to somewhere?
Yeah. I guess it's, you know, I think it's probably a little easier. It's certainly easier for bands to get attention if they happen to be inside the London or big city media bubble. You're probably more likely to get some good tours and all that kind of stuff if you're in LA, maybe not LA these days, but you know, if you're in New York or something, than if you're in like Wrexham.
Yeah, completely.
But there's also like a lot of bands, say in London, who do the same.
Which is bullshit, by the way.
Who do the same circuit all the time, like, you know, Blackheart, Underworld.
Yeah.
There's, you know, some of the smaller venues that they don't really break out of it, and they seem to be just happy to.
Yeah.
To do, to
which
do
is
that.
Cool because that's, you know, that's the backbone of what metal is. You know, you look at a lot of the bands that are on the Bloodstock Metal to the Masses initiative, which is a brilliant grassroots campaign that we have. We're proud to be involved in. you know, that there's loads of bands on that that are very kind of regional, if that's even a term you could use. And that's a real good platform for them to get up on stage. And I think, you know, the winners tend to end up playing Bloodstock and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's one good way. Get on the Bloodstock Mail to the Masses thing is a great way
to get involved. Yeah, I think it's a really good shout, actually.
But I also think it's also good to be involved in your scene with other bands, because I think once bands start to kind of cross-pollinate and they get ideas of each other, everything becomes more than the sum of its parts. So it's good to have like a local scene of people who you kind of share a similar aesthetic with, but you're all kind of different in your own way. Mm-hmm. And I know like the London scene, metal scene, especially the black metal scene, got way more interesting when bands started, you know, having affiliations with other bands, and they'd have members in other bands. And it was a long time in the sort of when all the black metal bands, English ones, would be like, we stand alone, you know, and just like, well, good, but you're not going to get anywhere. And they never seem to get any sense of momentum. But now, you know, with the, like bands like Voices and Nakakoka and Shrines, and you know, and all these people kind of having a kind of a scene, and they're all doing their own thing, but they're all getting inspiration from each other. And I think that tends to build up a kind of a head of steam and get you noticed. I mean, look at, say, Norway and Bergen, where, you know, a lot of people play in other bands and they share band members, and all these bands are unique, but they have a sensibility. And it's really creative. Or Tampere, where you've got, we did a piece on that recently, where you have all these really kind of strange cosmic black metal bands, but each one different, but there's a sense of you're bigger, there's something bigger than all of you.
Absolutely. So yeah, there's a lot of ways for to smaller bands to get recognition from larger sources. We're always listening as well. You know, tweet us your music, send it to us, send it to Jonathan here, he's the reviews editor.
I do listen to everything eventually.
Eventually, yeah.
So yeah, you can hit us all up, and we're always proud to rep for you wherever the hell you come from. Axel Piff asks on Twitter, with the constant genres, subgenres, or fusion genres of metal cropping up every day, do you think that it is a good thing or bad thing for the metal genre as a whole? So is it a good thing that we have more genres and subgenres than ever? I personally think that the idea of subgenre is becoming a bit obsolete in a lot of ways, because I think people's listening habits have changed so much.
I mean, I think you can go out as far as you want to go out, as long as you're still in dialogue with where it came from originally. Otherwise, you know, just like you've got a helium balloon and you cut the string off and it'll go off somewhere, but it's not metal anymore. Mm-hmm. It's not, it doesn't have any relation to metal, so you can call it what you want and whether you like listen to it or not. But when genres do go off into tangents, it's interesting because it's, I mean, I find it fascinating because it's, what does it say about the original core aspects of metal? So you know, just putting some kind of electric beats on old school thrash isn't going to make you very interesting or anything.
No,
like
of
that.
Course, it's got to be something that clicks and it works and it feels in line with, you know, where you're coming from and where you're going.
I think just not everything needs to be categorised as a certain strand of metal. You know, like synthwave metal fans are involved in, but it's not called synth metal or something like that. I think it's just, you know, it's its own little thing that we're all in on. But like metal fans are guilty of wanting everything they listen to be considered metal or heavy in some way, and so these subgenres get thrown out saying it's X, Y, and Z metal or post whatever metal.
Right, yeah.
And it's just so you can justify what you're listening to, like we mentioned earlier. And I think, you know, subgenres, you know, have become a lazy tool just to categorise something, when really you could just say it's a band that's obviously listened to this other band. Mm-hmm. When you don't need to call it post whatever or, you know, pre anything or whatever else, or something core. But but at the same time, I'm guilty of using them all the time.
Yeah, I mean, they're always going to have a use on there, because you can say, you know, if someone asks me what Power Trip sound like, I'm going to say they're a thrash band. That's the first thing we're going to say.
Yeah,
but completely. I'm going to go beyond that, because where you look at where the scene's at now, their roots are actually in hardcore, and even though they sound like Slayer, they come from a world that's, you know, as influenced by Hatebreed and Madball. And
yeah, you could just pull something out of your arse and basically go, oh, they're part of the new wave of crossover. That means nothing. But
well, you've said it now.
Yeah, exactly. but you hear that and you go, okay, I get what you mean by that. But you could, at the same time, you don't need to put them in a new box, just go, they're a thrash band.
Well, you just need to look at the Metal Hammer tour to see how the game is changing now, because that sounds like a cheap plug, but there's a reason we wanted to put this tour together in particular, because you've got you know, a kind of modern metal / heavy metal band in Trivium, death metal band in Venom Prison, a thrash crossover band in Power Trip, excuse me, and a, you know, increasingly loosely termed hardcore band in Code Orange. Mm. And they all go together because they're all just fucking wicked and they're all happy to be on that tour together because it just works.
But it is, sometimes it is useful because, you know, bands have a certain set of values. I mean, you know, the original scenes had a really strong set of values, so the hardcore scene, the punk scene. Mm-hmm. And so it annoys me when people call, say, Cult of Luna or Aim and Ra post-metal bands, because they actually all came from the hardcore scene.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their values are really set by the hardcore scene. And, you know, post-punk has a lot of dialogue with, you know, the original punk scene, but they obviously they went kind of quite gothy, and so there is you know, when you talk about genres, you're talking about a set of values to do with that genre.
Mm-hmm.
And how people relate to those genres. I mean, I still think of Aim and Ra as very much a hardcore band,
right?
Just they've taken it out into, you know, really new areas, but that's where they come from. We call them post hardcore or not, but it's useful to know that they came from the hardcore scene, same with Cult of Luna.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's useful to know that Neurosis came from the punk scene.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not the metal scene.
I think as long as it's good, like we said about the New Venice thing, as long as it's good, that's what matters most. Everything else is just down to the individual, really.
At Being Manny V on Twitter,
catchy,
asks, what is your opinion on holograms replacing musicians that are no longer with us? Should this be welcome thanks to technological advances, or should we leave legacy as is?
I think it's down to the you know, the families and those closest to the person to kind of have the best take on whether it's something they'd want to do. Personally, the idea of going to see a Dio hologram just doesn't interest me whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I think it's naff. But, you know, I know in that case, Wendy Dio, his widow, said she was cool with it. And so I don't think it's on fans to decide whether it's okay or not. But personally, it's not for me.
No, I think I'm the same. Like, there's, I can't think of any band that I'd want that to... Yeah, I'd want to see a hologram of, even bands that I've never seen. Like, yeah, I never saw Pantera, for example. I wouldn't want to see a hologram of Dimebag. I never saw Nirvana. I wouldn't want to see a hologram of Kurt Cobain. That would be the shittest thing you could ever see. But at the same time, you know, if you're a massive fan of that band and you just basically, it's better than seeing a tribute band, I guess. It's just the same.
I guess
there's no flesh and blood on stage, but I mean, maybe if you could like use them as samples. I mean, there's some artistic way you could use holograms that probably would piss off the people in charge of their legacies, but
I think there's ways you can do stuff, like, you know, I know that at Queen shows they still have videos of Freddie Mercury doing bits and stuff, and that's fine, that's different, but yeah. There you go.
It looks cool, but it's not for me.
Yeah, does it actually look cool? I went to see War of the Worlds, where they had the hologram of like Liam Neeson, and it just looked like a projection on a small screen somewhere. Like, wasn't that really that impressive?
Fair.
It wasn't like some kind of future thing where they just beam down and was in front of you.
Fair.
Star Trek. It is not.
Definitely not for us. Jay Hutchinson 74 asks, with Slayer and Sabbath stepping down and when the likes of Metallica and Maiden follow suit, please don't say that, who do you think will be the next top four bands? So I guess he's picking Slayer, Sabbath, Metallica and Maiden as the top four bands then.
It's hard to argue.
That's very we won't get into that.
I guess in terms of new, you could, you know, it depends when you think new, but the first bands that sprung to mind for me were like Avenged Sevenfold, Five Finger Death Punch.
Ooh.
As much as I don't like them, they're massive.
Yep. I'm with that 100%.
Yeah, and then you could even, you know, look at the trajectory Ghost are on.
Absolutely.
They could be up there.
I think Parkway Drive could be going in that vein as well.
Completely.
No spoilers.
But at the same time, there's bands, you know, like Slipknot aren't, you know, are obviously one of the biggest bands in the world, and they're not a new band.
Slipknot are already there, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if we're looking at bands that are going to be headlining festivals through the next, you know, 10 years, Slipknot, Avenged, I agree. I think Five Finger on that trajectory. I think Parkway are on that trajectory. I'll take that four.
Yeah.
When I saw Ghost...
Ghost as well,
I mean,
I mean, they're the one that excited me the most in a lot of ways, because they're
Played the Forum, that was the first time I thought, wow, this is actually a festival headliner band.
Absolutely, and as we said last week, there's stuff going on there, so we'll be keeping a very close eye on that. Thank you for tuning in, guys. Jonathan, thanks for joining us again. I'm sure we'll have you back on very soon.
I thought I was out there.
Do not miss two absolutely colossal albums coming out this Friday, tomorrow when this podcast goes out. Basically, two opposite ends of the British metal spectrum. The new Judas Priest album, Firepower, is an absolute destroyer. We, of course, talked to Rob Halford and Tony Iommi of Black Sabbath together in the new issue, but there's also a feature-length review from Dom Lawson, absolute Judas Priest lifer, that will move you, that will warm up your black metal bones. So get on that album. It really is an absolute return to form for them. It's absolutely incredible. And from the other end, the Conjurer album is finally with us as well.
Yes.
Another excellent young band. Very excited about it. Maya is, in my opinion, the debut of the year so far.
Yeah, definitely.
You probably go with that.
If you like riffs, then listen over and over again.
For hell fucking yes. And we also do talk to Conjurer in the new issue of Metal Hammer as well. So do pick it up. Support all those bands. And feel free to support us as well, because we massively appreciate it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and give it a good rating so we shoot up those iTunes ranks. What are you guys up to this week? You doing anything interesting?
I'm off to see Here Lies Man
this evening.
The Moth Club in London. So I'll be reporting back next week. I'm really, really looking forward to that.
Excellent.
The album's great. What are you doing? Anything exciting?
Nothing as good as that.
By way of contrast, I've got Obituary over the weekend.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, one of the first metal bands I actually saw live.
Amazing.
I saw them on the Cause of Death tour. So
still crushing it live.
Yeah, they're always amazing. By way of contrast, also Monday, I found this out this about a bit late. It's Anna von Hauswolf. Who we've got also in this issue of Metal Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
If you like Chelsea Wolfe and Darker and amazing singers like that who go off into weird dark territories, Anna von Hauswolf does just that, but in her own amazing way. And she's really sold out the Dome.
Oh wow, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's
so it's just like everyone's just like, you mentioned that her name.
The Dome is for people outside London. That's like a
700.
Decent, not bad.
Solo singer songwriter. Yeah,
a lot going on there now. In that scene, isn't there? Very, very cool. We'll catch up very soon, Jonathan and Luke. Yep. See you and the return of Elle next week.
She'll
be telling us about her New York adventures. Cheers, everyone. Stay metal. Pick up the new issue and be cool to each other. I don't even know where I was going with that. Bye.
Cheers. Be metal.